Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Panic swept world stock markets this week. On Monday, nervous investors in Asia looked at the U.S. economy and recession fears and launched a global sell-off. It was huge. Yesterday, the Fed jumped in. The White House and Congress promised action. Wall Street still fell, but less than feared. There were rebounds globally, but everyone's still on pins and needles, and it shows. This hour, On Point, the global economic quake and where it ends. Joining me first today from London is Philip Coggan, capital markets editor at The Economist magazine. He's been watching the markets for over 20 years. He's author of the upcoming book, Guide to Hedge Funds, What They Are, What They Do, Their Risks, Their Advantages. Welcome to the show, Philip Coggan. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
It's always tricky to talk about these things because the markets are global. There's, you know, one is always doing something or is asleep, and our listeners are going to hear this at all different times. But as we speak, what's the situation today? We know the Dow opened and went down quickly. What do you see going on globally, Philip?
Yeah. Well, we had a bit of a rally in Asia overnight in response to that Fed rate cut. The Hong Kong market was up 10%, which was pretty extreme. But, of course, the Chinese market and other Asian markets have fallen quite heavily previously. But as the day has worn on, the mood has got darker and darker. And in Europe, we are down 3% as we speak at the moment. And the worry in Europe is that while the Fed may cut rates, it's clear that the European Central Bank isn't going to in the short term. Our equivalent of Ben Bernanke, Jean-Claude Trichet, made a speech today worrying about inflation. So that indicates that he's not ready to do the same sort of thing as the Fed. And the Bank of England also, it doesn't sound as if it's going to cut rates as dramatically as the Fed has done. So while we are worried about the U.S. economy and the effect of the U.S. economy on the rest of the world, it's clear that other central banks are not prepared to act as swiftly as the Fed has done.
Philip Coggan, in London, you know, earlier this week, just a day or two ago, the word was panic. Is that still the word? I mean, everybody was using it, not exactly on Wall Street, but certainly in Asia, maybe in Europe. Is that still the word, or have things settled a bit? How do you read it?
I think extreme nervousness, if not quite panic. The problem is that people went for a long time buying risky assets and thinking that all would be well, that company profits would keep climbing, that people would repay their debts. And we saw in the credit markets, in the bond markets, in the middle of last year, things turn around. And it took a while for the truth to really dawn on the stock market. And it's only really in the first few weeks of this year that it started to realize, equity investors started to realize that the U.S. economy is faltering and it may drag the rest of the world down with it. And as they look at that, they then start to worry about all sorts of investments. So it's not just stock markets are falling, commodity prices are falling. We are seeing a widening in the cost that risky companies have to pay for their debts, and that's going to make it, of course, more difficult for them. So we're seeing investors really retreat from all the things that might get in trouble if the economy slows and move into the things that they think are safe, like treasury bonds, which they know will keep their value.
Philip, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down about 10% since the beginning of this year. That's pretty rotten. The worst 14-day trading days ever in its history. You know, we're touching some kind of superlatives on the dark side here, on the negative side, in terms of how big these losses have been. With all that going on, why wouldn't the European Central Bank step up anyway with a rate cut? Why are they more concerned about inflation than Washington?
Well, the problem is, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know this, that the prices that most consumers pay have been going up. The gas that you pay for, the food that you pay for in the supermarkets, all these things have been rising. And inflation rates, the headline inflation rates, are higher than the European Central Bank would want them to be. What they don't want to happen is for workers to put in big pay rises to compensate them for those higher prices. And then we get into the kind of wage price spiral we saw in the 1970s. So the European Central Bank thinks its primary function is to control inflation. And it's going to make sure it does that. So until we get those prices coming down, then the ECB isn't going to change. Now, the good news about that is at least oil has come down $10 or so from its peak, and we have been seeing the last few days a bit of a decline in other commodity prices as well. Corn has fallen 6 days in a row, for example. So eventually that might lead to lower food prices for the rest of us.
From your perspective, sitting in London, a big financial center in itself, is there something, anything, that the U.S. government could do at this point? There's the Fed with a 3/4-point rate cut, historically large. There's the White House and Congress talking about $140, $50 billion stimulus plan. But I guess the response so far would suggest that's not enough. Is there something they could do to stop it?
I think they're doing as much as can be expected. The problem is that these things take time to work. It's generally accepted it takes a year to 18 months for interest rate cuts to affect the economy. And even if the Congress agrees on a tax cut, it probably won't be till late summer, early autumn before the money actually ends up in taxpayers' pockets. And we've got to get to the first half of the year before then. And homeowners are still struggling with falling house prices and, of course, higher gas prices and things like that. Unemployment has started to move up in the States. So for the first 6 months of the year, probably what the Fed does now won't help, and we're still suffering from what was happening last year.
So no rock to grab onto quite yet. Philip Coggan, capital markets editor at The Economist in London, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're looking at the global economic quake, the stock market panic earlier this week, where things stand now and where the meltdown might end. Joining me now in the studio is Jeffrey Frankel, professor of capital formation and growth at Harvard University's Kennedy School. He's a former member of the Council of Economic Advisors under Bill Clinton. He directs the program in international finance and macroeconomics at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Jeffrey Frankel, welcome. Good to have you back.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And joining us from New York is Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, co-founder, board member of the Economic Policy Institute. He's author of the new book, The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. He's been predicting a tough recession for months now and is not convinced that cutting interest rates will fix the mess. Bob Kuttner, thanks for being here. Welcome back.
Nice to be back.
What's your big read? What's your interpretation? What's going on, Robert Kuttner?
I think, first of all, this recession is different from any recession since the Great Depression because this was a needless recession caused by excessive financial engineering that has now led to serious damage to the balance sheets of large financial institutions, which then cascades over into the rest of the economy. And it's doubly serious because, pardon me, it's being combined with an uptick in inflation. It's coming on the heels of increasing dependency of the U.S. on foreign borrowing. It has been partly responsible for severe losses in the housing market. And all of this is on top of a 30-year slide in living standards for a majority of Americans and sectoral increases in costs like college tuition and health insurance and energy, which means that the usual anti-recession medicine, a rate cut, even a big rate cut, a spending package or a tax reduction package equal to about 1% of GDP, is not going to fix what's broken because so much of the damage is long-term and so much of the damage is structural. And I don't think stimulus is even a good word. I think you need a recovery program. Stimulus implies a kind of a macroeconomic leaning against the wind, and this is a bigger problem than that.
Jeffrey Frankel, how about it? Are we in new territory here? Will the old, you know, medicine not work this time? Do we need something more, different?
I agree about two-thirds with what Bob Kuttner said. I think that this – I mean, of course, we don't know whether we're in a recession yet. We typically don't know till much later given the delays and measurement errors in data collection.
Formally, officially, you're part of the National Bureau of Economic Research that finally will tell us what you think one way or the other. Officially, Washington says no. Many people say, well, they think we are already, but here we are.
Right. I mean, the NBR doesn't do it until much later, till all the numbers are in. But, you know, it's possible we're already in it. But I do agree that if we are in a recession or if one comes soon, it is likely to be more severe and longer lasting than the last one anyway, which was in 2001. And I don't think it's because the traditional tools wouldn't work exactly. I think that the unusual measures that were taken yesterday before the market opened yesterday being Tuesday morning opening.
The Fed kind of rolling out in the middle of the night practically ahead of its meeting and launching this big cut.
almost unprecedented, 75 basis point cut in interest rates just before its meeting. And at the same time, the Secretary of the Treasury gave a speech where he outlined what they have in mind for the stimulus package. But I think – and these will help. This will, you know, they will moderate. But I think that the policymakers are sharply limited in how much they can do. They can't really go much beyond that. They're limited in how steeply they can cut interest rates because the dollar is going down and there's risk of inflation. Mm-hmm. And they're limited in how much they can cut tax rates because or increase spending because we've got these big budget deficits now and the big national debt. And that is very different than was the case last time around. In 2001, the Fed had the freedom to cut interest rates extraordinary, 550 basis points.
Greenspan almost to zero.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and that's – I mean, it's literally impossible now. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, the dollar was strong in 2001. Inflation was low, and so the Fed was free to act.
Is there a risk of a free fall in that case?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think that the Fed will start to feel increasingly constrained that the dollar could go into free fall, and we have to worry more than we used to about what global investors think about U.S. assets because we're now this this big net debtor as a result of borrowing for all these years. What's getting the most attention is sovereign wealth funds and, you know, the
foreign investment cash.
Mm-hmm. Right, but that, I mean, that's actually a small part of it. The point is we're borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars a year. We now have $3 trillion of net international debt, and so we have to start to worry more about what investors think around the world.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about this week's global stock market panic and what it said or says about the global economy. I'm joined by Jeffrey Frankel, professor of capital formation and growth at Harvard's Kennedy School, author of American Economic Policy in the 1990s. From New York, Robert Kuttner joins us. He's co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, author of The Squandering of America. Jeffrey Frankel, what about these other colossal economies that everybody's been raving about for years now? They've become so big. They've become so rich. China, India. I thought part of the notion was that they had their own kind of economic action going on now, and they wouldn't necessarily just keel over when the U.S. got in trouble. Why isn't there something happening in Asia to counterbalance what's happened in the U.S.?
So the buzzword has been decoupling. Up until now, there's been speculation that even if the U.S. went into recession, that Asia, especially, and the rest of the world would be decoupled and wouldn't be affected. I don't know if anyone literally believed there wouldn't be any effect. Point number one is there's certainly financial contagion. I mean, we couldn't have seen a more dramatic illustration of that than over the last few days, where what happens in when one stock market opens in one part of the world depends so heavily on what happened in the stock market that was open in the previous time zone. And, you know, the Shanghai stock market was way overvalued. I mean, it's not just the U.S. market that was overvalued. And there's housing bubbles in other countries. And the general underpricing of risk that we had a year or two ago, which I think was very serious, wasn't just in the United States. It was everywhere around the world.
So underpricing of risk. That's kind of the Robert Shiller call that?
Irrational exuberance.
Irrational exuberance. Is that what that sort of means? The underpricing of risk, blindness, bubble, giddiness?
Well, that's part of it. That's part of it. But it showed up, I think, particularly clearly in the spreads that low-grade corporations had to pay, the famous junk bonds, which normally have to pay a pretty high spread because of the risk of default. Mm-hmm. They had an extraordinary low spread. And the same thing if you look at the volatilities that are in options prices or if you look at other spreads that are supposed to be measuring risk. The spreads that emerging markets had to pay on their debt, everything was just very, very low.
And easy money everywhere.
Yeah, easy money and underperception of risk. And the two, I think, were probably related. And that's where we were a couple years ago. So I think it was inevitable that we would have a substantial correction in the world's security prices. And you can use the word panic, except it's based in fundamentals in a sense that the markets were artificially
high.
You
say if we go to recession, you fear it may be more severe and last longer, certainly than 2001, maybe than what lots of investors and ordinary regular citizens are used to these days. How severe? How long?
Well, that's very hard to say, but of course. But the 2001 recession was relatively quite mild and quite short-lived. Before the break, I mentioned one reason for that was a very aggressive easing of monetary policy, which they were free to do. The other is we had this fantastic fiscal stimulus. And when I say fantastic, I mean out of a realm of fantasy, because it was a switch in the long-term fiscal prospects of the United States, the tax cuts for the rich, eliminating the estate tax, and effective in the year 2010. Dividends, capital gains, and all of this. And
the whole Bush program sort of took the lid off.
Yeah, which was a swing. I mean, when he took office, we had a budget surplus, and there was a projected budget surplus going 10 years in the future of, I think it was $5 trillion or something. And then that was converted to a record budget deficit. And if you look forward 10 years, it's a prospect of a $5 trillion deficit accumulated 10 years. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a $10 trillion swing, which is a huge change in our fiscal future, creating all sorts of long-term problems. Now, you can't spend that much money without having some stimulus effect, and that did happen in 2001, and I think was one of the reasons why that recession was relatively mild. And they were free to do that because they had inherited this huge surplus. Well, they can't do that again. We've got these big deficits. We're facing the retirement of the baby boom generation, big deficits in Social Security and Medicare looming. So they can't have a huge stimulus package, and this one doesn't work. They can't really repeat it. So I would say both monetary and fiscal policy, which in 2001 were free to respond sharply, are constrained this time around.
Bob Cutner, you said earlier a stimulus package won't cut it this time. You said we need what you called a recovery package. What do you mean by that?
Yes, thank you. Let me agree partly with Jeff and take issue with one thing. I think policymakers are limited partly by the structural constraints that Jeff spoke about, but I think they're also limited by their own imaginations. So for starters, I would take a look at what's going on in housing. The projected loss in housing values, which is represents the net worth of more than 100 million American families, that's going to take a hit of $2.2 trillion this year.
$2.2 trillion. And you're talking the subprime debacle and the housing downturn and all the rest.
I'm talking about what's going to happen to housing prices using the Case-Shiller index and projecting it out for the rest of the year. And that, of course, was partly a naturally occurring bubble, but it was partly supercharged by subprime. So this is not going to fix itself because these mortgages have been turned into bonds. And once a mortgage is packaged with other mortgages into a bond, it's very difficult to do a workout with your local lender to cut the interest rate so you don't lose your home because the local lender is not the holder of the mortgage. So for
Bob,
starters—
just to keep it clear, this is where it's no longer the local banker holding your mortgage, but it's packaged up and sold out into the whole world.
Yeah, and God knows who owns it. So, I mean, it might be a bank. It might be a pension fund. It might be there was a town in northern Norway that got into trouble because they had been induced to buy some of this stuff. We need something like the Homeowners Loan Corporation of the 1930s, which could buy back some of this stuff at a discount and use that discount to turn this paper back into mortgages that would have a below market rate so that people would not lose their homes and other people could afford to buy some of these vacant homes. And you'd put a floor under the slide in housing values, which I think is the single most serious part of this. You compare a $2.2 trillion hit to the net worth of Americans to a stimulus package of $145 billion, you realize the disproportion of what's needed.
You're saying government step in and mop up this subprime to own that, to get all that slack out of the system.
Yes, but this would not cost taxpayers any money. Homeowners Loan Corporation actually returned a slight profit to the Treasury. This would be a facilitating agency. It would buy these bonds back, and it would either make the mortgages itself at a below-market rate because of the discount at which it bought these bonds. And let's remember, a lot of these bonds are effectively worthless because they have no buyers.
I don't hear the White House or Congress saying anything like that unless I've missed it at the moment, Bob Cutner.
No, they haven't. And the politics of this are very interesting. Every housing expert that I've interviewed says we need something like this. But the Republicans are gun-shy because this would be a big government agency and they want to do it voluntarily. The Democrats are gun-shy because it feels like a bailout. It really wouldn't be a bailout because the bondholders would be taking the hit. And if we don't do something like this, the depression in housing values is going to drag down the rest of the economy. The other thing that I would do, by the way, we need to think a lot bigger in terms of this stimulus. For example, what's happening now to state and local governments is that their tax revenues are decreasing. The demand for services is increasing, but because every state save one has a constitutional requirement to run a balanced budget, states are going to have to pull back on services at the very time that the rest of the economy is contracting. This is what economists refer to as a pro-cyclical response. Mm-hmm. It intensifies what's going on.
Falls into it, yep.
Rather than leaning against the wind.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put a couple of $100 billion out in the form of emergency revenue sharing so that states didn't have to deepen the recession, and you did things like an emergency cut in the payroll tax or an emergency increase in Social Security payouts, you could get money into the economy very quickly. You wouldn't have to wait 6 months. And yes, this would temporarily increase the deficit, but that's exactly what you want to do during a severe recession. Mm. You want to temporarily increase the deficit so that purchasing power doesn't fall through the floor.
You're talking big emergency measures there, and I want to get Jeffrey Frankel's response, but I want to get our listeners into this conversation as well. Let's take a call from Paul in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Part of the problem is why we're in this tremendous mess is that a Republican Congress and a Republican White House have followed their long and glorious tradition in refusing to regulate a marketplace and refusing to regulate a banking industry that engaged in predatory lending practices. I look forward to having a Democrat in the White House who will force the marketplace and force the banks to behave in an ethical and moral manner.
Paul, let us pick it up. Jeff Frankel, how about it? Do you see responsibility laid down here, banking industry left to just kind of run off the reservation? And will pulling it back, will bringing more regulation, while it may be necessary, but would it also be a break on economic recovery?
Well, I agree with Paul that at least one part of the problem is I don't know if I'd call it predatory, but that we need better consumer protection, that there were plenty of households who took out kinds of mortgages that just weren't well suited to them at all, and that the regulators have neglected that. I don't think that's the whole problem or even the biggest part of the problem. Bob Kuttner mentioned that the big fall in housing prices, loss of $2 trillion of wealth, that would have had a huge impact on the economy even if there had not been any subprime mortgages.
But wasn't it fueled, blown up bigger by the subprime craziness?
Maybe some. I think easy monetary policy had a mm-hmm. lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But also, I think that there is a policy, an attitude in this country that everyone needs to own their own home, which sounds great, and no politician has ever disagreed with that with either party. And they both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration always pointed proudly when the percentage of home ownership went up year after year.
Mm-hmm.
But there can be such a thing as too high home ownership. There's some people who just can't aren't in a financial position where they can afford to buy a home, and you're not doing them any favor by giving them big mortgages with no money down and, you know, all interest payments. And that is quantitatively a big part of it as well. And I'm not sure what the regulators can do about that. If the plan is to try to put an artificial floor under housing prices, I don't think that'll really work. I think housing prices were too high, just like some other kinds of asset prices in the economy. And it sort of does have to find its bottom.
May I jump in?
Yes, Bob.
But that doesn't mean that a cratering of the housing market is a good thing. I mean, to some extent, the bubble was the result of wishful thinking. To some extent, the bubble was the result of overly easy monetary policy that Greenspan put in place to try and mop up earlier bubbles. But certainly, subprime, the whole practice of taking people who barely qualified to become homeowners under the best of circumstances and giving them these bait-and-switch loans, which almost guaranteed that after a couple of years when the rate went up, they would go into a default, that was bad policy. And at a more primary level, allowing financial institutions to create these exotic products, which allowed collateralized debt obligations, which turned out to be built on sand, to be purchased by people who didn't quite realize what they were purchasing, that is what has unleashed these toxins into the stream of global commerce. And surely with the benefit of hindsight, and some of us were saying this at the time, it was not a good idea to throw away the regulatory rule book and say that anything the market does by definition is good because it's innovation. I mean, when you think about it, internet child pornography is innovation. Dirty bombs are innovation. Mm. Not mm. all innovations are efficient. Not all innovations are good. And by throwing away the regulatory rule book, the supposed regulators, the bank regulatory agencies, mm. the Republican Congress, the Fed, virtually invited these kinds of abuses in the same way that we had very similar abuses in the 1920s.
We've got the point. Paul in Chapel Hill, thanks very much for calling. Let's take a call from Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
It's refreshing to hear a voice like Mr. Kuttner's on your program. And I guess this question, I was glad to hear Mr. Kuttner put this in the perspective of a 30-year or a 40-year view, because it seems like a lot of these problems started with the Reagan administration, especially the decrease in incomes. I've watched that happen over the course of my lifetime. To the degree where it really seems like the 30s were really an anomaly in our country, really, when the government really did represent the interests of average people. And I think the rule is the government...
Well, you had pretty good income growth for average folks in the late 50s, into the 60s.
Right,
even.
And that's it. That's it. It was that period of time, and that's the anomaly in this country. And this, I think the rule, rather, is that the government generally represents the interests of the ownership class. And my point is that if you see it the way I do, that economic power and political power are essentially the same thing, that if you can't decouple economic power from political power, then none of this will ever be taken care of. Because I'm not sure any of this really matters to people who own a lot of wealth. It's just, you know, a ride one way or the other. It's not going to ruin their lives. They'll get through this. But to average people, this is the difference between being able to live and survive and not. And I guess my question for your guests is do you see economic power and political power as so inextricably linked in this country that unless that is cut, this can never change?
Bob Kuttner, Sam's a fan. How do you see it? A shared fate here or something else, and why?
Well, what Sam just articulated is the essence of what I argued in The Squandering of America. I think the question is whether we have enough of a financial crisis in a country that, after all, is still a political democracy, even though concentrated wealth enjoys a disproportionate amount of political power, whether this crisis is going to force Democrats to really start behaving like Democrats used to behave and articulate and champion the interests of ordinary people and harness a market economy once again for the public good. And that, unfortunately, despite the success of the 1990s under Clinton, that's a habit the Democrats have gradually gotten away from, I think because of the power of free market ideology, the power of campaign finance. A lot of the Democrats were, not all of them, but some of them were almost as culpable as the Republicans in thinking that the deregulation of Wall Street was nothing but good. Bob Rubin, Treasury Secretary, a former top guy at Goldman Sachs, subsequently top guy at Citigroup, mm-hmm. which exists only because of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, over which Mr. Rubin presided. I would like to see more difference between the parties on the subject of whether you need to harness capitalism in the public interest. I think this is a year when the Democrats need to do that. If not, they lose whatever tactical advantage the opposition party ordinarily enjoys when a severe recession happens on the watch of the incumbent party.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the week's global stock market turmoil and what it says about the global economy. We've been joined by economist Jeffrey Frankel and Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. Let's get a call from Mary in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment that I think it's hard for the public at large to take in the meaning of the global turmoil because it's couched in academic language and which makes it interesting to people who are inclined that way. But for the average, let's say, voter, it might be more fruitful to explain express it in terms of we personally, individually, have run up debts all over town, or now, so to speak, all over the world, and now we've realized we can't pay them, and we're going to throw up our hands and leave everybody else holding the bag.
Mary, it's interesting. You say boil it down so it's clear what it all means, but when you boil it down, you boil it down to individual responsibility. Maybe are you taking the rap for this, Mary?
Yes, certainly, because I think a person who buys more with a credit card than he or she can pay for is responsible personally. And politicians are not going to tell us that because people don't want to hear it. I mean, the answer, presumably, and I'm not knocking economic measures by government and by people skilled in these matters, but in fact, some equivalent of putting the country on a diet of bread and water is going to be the ultimate outcome, whether we like it or not.
Mary, let us pick that up. And Jeffrey Frankel, I'll come first to you. Here's Mary's challenge. Boil this down, this difficult situation, to terms that people can easily absorb so it can become part of the political conversation of this country. And in those terms, what do you make, among other things, of where Mary puts responsibility, individual debt?
Well, it's always good advice for a professor to remember to try to avoid overly abstruse academic language. And I think she put a part of the problem very well. And I do think we all are to blame as citizens in some ways. And one is, I agree with her, that the household saving rate in the U.S. has been close to zero. The Chinese save almost half of their income, and we save zero. And that is part of the problem, and people buying houses on credit that they shouldn't have bought. But I think that's only a bit of it. I would like to tie Mary's comment that, you know, we have to look inside ourselves for the root of our problems to something we were talking about just before the last break, which was Sam, I think it was the name of the caller, who said that the problem is that government represents the ownership class. And, you know, the thing is, it's true that in the last 7 years, the government has adopted all kinds of measures to benefit the ownership class, cutting dividends taxes, capital gains taxes, eliminating the estate tax. But, you know, I don't think the ownership class has a lock on the government. We voted, well, I didn't, but the American public voted, if not in 2000, then in 2004, for George Bush. And they got the policies that implied. And that's a different sense in which I think that we all bear responsibility for what's happened. I don't think there's anything preventing us from electing a government that would do the kinds of things that Bob Kuttner was talking about. I mean, at the moment, you know, aid to states, an emergency cut in the payroll tax. It's absolutely what we should be doing. And the administration, after 7 years, to give them a little bit of credit, has finally encountered a problem to which they're not reacting. Oh, this shows why we have to enact more permanent tax cuts for the rich. But we want to go way beyond the compromises that they now appear to be willing to make, I think. But, you know, got to vote for the leaders you want.
Bob Kuttner, is it going to take, as Mary says, a bread and water diet for, you know, the ordinary guy and gal to clean this mess up, the sort of Argentina path, or is there another way?
Oh, there's another way. I mean, it's very interesting. In researching this book, I read a lot of histories of the 20s and 30s, and there were people after the crash in 1929, a lot of them on Wall Street, saying, you know, this is good for the economy. Purge the rot. Let wages and prices fall to their natural level, bread and water. And, of course, it took Roosevelt to come along and say, no, what the economy doesn't need is bread and water. What the economy needs is to put people back to work, producing things that the country needs. And we slowly climbed out of the recession. So a bread and water diet would be the worst possible remedy. I also think that to say that we're all to blame for this is not right. It's misleading. Some of us had more power than others over public policy, and some of us have more blame than others. The trade policy that allowed accounts to be come imbalanced and rely on foreign borrowing, that could not go on forever. That wasn't Mary's fault. And I think while some people use credit cards to buy things that they don't really need, other people are reliant on credit cards for life's necessities because paychecks haven't kept up with the cost of living, and that's the fault of other bad public policy. So I think Also, all debts are not created equal. The trade deficit and the foreign debt is very serious. The Social Security deficit is a problem that can be relatively easily solved with minor fine-tuning. So it's not helpful to lump all of these debts together and say all of us did it. What's helpful is to unpack it into policies that can be easily reversed, policies that are more difficult to reverse, and then think through what we need to do.
There's another huge piece here that I think a lot of people were counting on that hasn't quite come through yet, and that is that maybe big engines in Asia would kick in and bail everybody out. I want to bring another voice into this conversation to look at that. From Chicago, Amit Saru joins us, assistant professor of finance at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business. Amit Saru, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So the U.S. economy looks like it may be in trouble, maybe in recession already, maybe headed there. And instead of China and India that have made so much, and we've heard so much about their booms, instead of them kicking in and kind of pulling the whole thing forward, they have appeared early this week to be, at least their stock markets, practically collapsing. Why?
Basically, there was an aura of exact invincibility in Indian and Chinese markets, where people thought that, you know, they are insulated from anything that happens in the U.S. But essentially, if you see what's been driving the growth in India and China, I mean, India, it's basically the services sector, which is predominantly dependent on firms in the U.S. So it's not a surprise if firms in the U.S. see a negative shock that this has some effect on firms in India.
But we thought at some point these economies would get so big that India would be trading with China, China would be selling to Malaysia, Indonesia selling to India, you know, that it would all kind of work in one big happy engine out there. Is that anywhere on the horizon? Does it all still depend on American consumers and finance and the rest?
It is happening, but I think it will still take some time for these economies to take everything on their shoulders. Because essentially, if you see where the investments in these economies is coming from, it's coming from foreign investors who are, have a lot of money parked in the U.S. as well as in these economies as well. So if these investors are hit with some bad things like they were with this housing crisis in the U.S., it's not surprising that they start closing their positions in India and China, and that creates a sort of a negative momentum, the one which we saw recently.
Amit, let me ask you then, is the United States going to have to take the lead in turning this around and fixing it? I mean, does it really all depend on what the Fed does and the stimulus package out of Washington and maybe on a whole recovery restructuring, as Bob Kuttner suggests? Is Asia going to sit and watch and maybe swoon some more and wait for the United States to clean it up?
I mean, at this point, I would love to say no, but I think, unfortunately, the answer for some more years is going to be yes.
Wow.
I mean, you can already see the effect, like the Fed cut happened and already the markets revived, almost bounced back completely today in India and China. So you can already see that, and there was nothing that happened in these markets overnight except the U.S. Fed cut. So clearly they look up to whatever happens in the U.S. very, very closely, even though for the past year or so they wanted to believe that the markets are decoupled.
Let's take a call, if I may, from Augusta, Georgia. Jared is on the line. Hi, Jared. You're on the air.
Hi. It's good to speak with you, Tom.
You too.
Just one question. Why not just take the hit and regroup? I kind of feel like we're watching the rich kid and his father's kind of bailing him out time after time. So why not?
Who do you see being bailed out? And what do you mean? Just sort of take
our economy in general.
So just take the recession, even if it's long, and just take it, ride through, and don't complain about it? That's a lot of thin gruel, Jared.
Right. Sometimes it takes a burn-off for our environment in order to have fresh new growth.
So that's the burn-off bread-and-water scenario again. Jared, thanks for calling. Jeffrey Frankel, Bob Kuttner says FDR taught the nation and the world that that's not the way to do it. But you hear the voice of the people bringing it up again.
Well, of course, FDR originally ran for office the first time for president on a platform of we needed more fiscal discipline than we had, but then he reversed. There's got to be a happy middle ground between these two extremes. I mean, Bob Kuttner seems to be essentially saying we should, and he can correct me if I'm misrepresenting him, but that we should be insulating people, for example, owners, borrowers, from any ill effects whatsoever. And Jared seems to be saying complete purging and no insulation whatsoever. The right answer is in between. We do have to worry about, sorry for the technical jargon, but moral hazard. If you bail people out, they'll take risks next time. They won't be as careful next time. We have to allow for that to some extent, but that doesn't mean you don't do anything, because we do have it in our power to moderate the downward effects. So it's a trade-off, and there's a happy medium.
Let's go to Bruce. Bruce in Boston. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey.
Excellent show. Yesterday, I listened to the NBC and said I'd never listen again after listening to Mr. Kramer. So it was very nice to hear you. I have a question for Mr. Kuttner, if I could.
Yes.
In your very excellent book, you refer to George Romney and Burger King and Bain Capital and trying to buy the National Hockey League.
George Romney or Mitt the Sun?
I'm sorry, Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney, okay, yeah.
Right. And I wondered if you think that some of the Bain Capital maneuvers will come up in the election. And you also referred to Republican legislation in 1996 that allowed these funds like Bain Capital to evade discovery. I wonder if you could expand on that a bit, please.
Bruce, thanks. Bob Kuttner, here's a reference to Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney and his turnaround work in the Burger King and maybe other instances. You'll know more than I. What do you say?
Well, I think this is a little bit esoteric. I think if Mitt Romney is the nominee, or even perhaps during the primary, some people may throw this at him. I think it's kind of a connoisseur's point. It's the sort of point that is hard to raise in the context of a general election, because you have to get into good private equity and bad private equity and which practices are conflicts of interest and that sort of thing.
Our time is short, then. Talk about political inclinations in the presidential race. I mean, do you see Romney or anybody else exhibiting the kind of – or talking about the kind of plans or exhibiting the kind of instincts that you think would head toward a repair here?
I think there's going to be a huge difference between the two parties. The Democrats would not go quite as bold as I would, but I think you're going to see on display the free market ideology, the cut taxes, that'll fix it, cut spending, versus a slightly paler version of the New Deal and the Great Society. And I think given what's going on, the New Deal, Great Society, remedy wins. I do want to take issue with one thing that Jeff said. Mm-hmm. I don't think I represent one extreme. I think there were some people who took out subprime loans to speculate, and you don't want to bail them out. But most of these people, if you actually look at who they are, they were people in good faith trying to realize the American dream, who got tricked into taking out bait-and-switch mortgages. And I don't think it's moral hazard to make it possible for those folks to keep their homes. I think it's what we need to do to keep the housing depression from dragging down the whole economy.
Amit Seru, let me ask you about something I heard New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg. There was some tape played on NPR's Morning Edition today, and he said he was talking about the stimulus plan that Washington is considering now and whether it should go more to middle class and lower middle class or to business. And he said something like, you know, what's the point of spreading it around to where people will spend it quickly? If they just go out and spend it, you know, what they buy will have been produced outside the United States. It's going to come out of, I don't know, Chinese factories or Indian factories for that matter. What do you think about that, Amit? If we spread the stimulus package around, give a few hundred dollars to everybody and they go to Walmart, if everything they buy was made in China, does that circle back around and stimulate the U.S. economy?
I would think so, because if we see the statistics, I mean, consumer spending is 70% of GDP in the U.S., so they are clearly the driving force behind the growth in the U.S. I mean, it's a fair point that a lot of this goes back to China and India and stimulates growth in those economies as well, but then since everything is linked and not decoupled as we thought, it basically comes back to stimulating the growth in the U.S. as well. So I think it's not a fair point to say that most of the money, even if it goes to the consumers, will go out of the U.S.
So you see it cycling back through. Jeff Frankel, our time is short, and the issue and challenges are so large. Just look very broadly at the presidential campaign? I mean, we're talking, Bob Kuttner's raising a kind of, you know, New Deal, New Society scale call for action here. I don't hear that on the campaign trail yet from either party. In fact, I'd say that the free market message, if I look across everybody, is still much more dominant, and the American people have clearly responded to that for a long time. Do you really see this country changing its fundamental political economic course in response to what we may be headed into right now?
And as far as the presidential election goes, it is an important point that historically the most important determinant of whether the incumbent party stays in the White House is what's happening to the economy in the year preceding the election, not over 4 years. So this is bad news for the Republicans, this slowing down. I agree with you. I don't hear anything about any support for some fundamental new great society kind of program or whatever. I don't think the problem with this past administration has been rigid adherence to free market, small government ideology. They have done plenty of big government things, like running the deficits, huge budget deficits,
yep,
like increasing the size of spending, like bailing out and giving subsidies to the oil industry and to agriculture and to airlines. The rhetoric is there for free market, but that's not what they actually do.
Well, choices to be made. Looking ahead, we've got to start on today, and clearly there's much more to be said. We will not let it go. Jeffrey Frankel at the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, professor of capital formation and growth there. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Amit Seru in Chicago, University of Chicago. Thank you for joining us, Professor Seru.
Thank you so much.
And Bob Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect, author of The Squandering of America. Bob, thank you very much for being here.
Always a pleasure, and thanks for the show.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.